We go. Well, this is I've lately, those of you who've watched the channel know that not too long ago I did a video with four of the OG randos, some of the first guys on the channel. And now that it's been 4 years, I messed up counting. Oh, good. Here comes Sherry. It's been 4 years, not three. I thought, what a good time to bring some of the veterans together. People who have been around this channel for a while. Nate, probably not as much, not as long as some of the others around here. When did you sort of jump onto this little corner? Hey, Sherry.
If it's been 4 years, I'd say like almost the midpoint, but not quite. I think it's been almost 2 years. Maybe it's like 20 months or something like that. It's okay. Like, I don't think it's quite 2 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I labeled this group the esoteric OG randos because all of you have been, well, you've been regulars on Karen's channel, on Nate's channel, on Randos United, on the Discord server. Well, Karen's not on the Discord server too much, but I see the four of you as being leaders in the community in sort of the, it's, I don't know why I clumped this group together because Karen is, you know, Karen is very much evangelical and Nate's an anarchist. And I haven't, you know, Sherry's been, you know, going Orthodox. And Michael, have you been going Orthodox too? Or what have you been doing in terms of your life outside of these screens?
I've been Anglican, but I've considered Orthodoxy, but I don't know that my wife would go for it.
that's always so. Maybe
in my case, it's my son who won't go for it. My wife is Jewish and doesn't care, but that's why I'm in the Anglican boat with you, Michael.
So let's maybe start by going around the circle and take a little time each of you to talk about your journey in this little corner. How it's changed you, why you think it's important, and once we do that a little bit after we've gone around and done some talking about that, maybe where it's going. So that's what this video is going to be about. Okay. Anybody can go first.
Well, for me, it's like it's finding people who are also explorers, I suppose, is the best way mm-hmm. I could put it. Because for me, if life ceases to be a journey and a transformation, then you're probably dead. So, this is a place where you find a lot of people that seem to approach life with the same way and are never fully satisfied with, you know, any, you know, with the, or thinking that they've absolutely arrived at the solution. And always know that there's more to discover. And that's always been my life trajectory. It just kind of is a place where I found a lot of people that are, you know, have a similar temperament, I suppose. Similar orientation.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, I'll go next. My life has changed a lot since I first talked to you, Paul. I've gotten married. I have a kid. I would definitely say that this corner of the internet has definitely had an impact on that because that wasn't really the trajectory I was on prior to that for lots of reasons. So I would say that that's definitely impacted that course change. I'll also piggyback on what Nate was just saying, where it just, I think this sort of opening to the world being much more wonderful and strange than I thought. And that, that sort of wonderfulness and strangeness is not, absent from, or separate from the revelation we have in Christ, that there's something, those two things may seem very separate and distinct, but if you really pay attention, that there's connections to be made.
Karen and Sherry, no place to hide.
Well, I'll go. First of all, I want to say it's kind of interesting because I started my journey with Paul and Karen. and it's really nice to be back with you. And I mean, my journey here with this community of people, and it has totally enriched my life. Like, I said to Nate the other day, it's like the valley of, you know, being in the valley of dry bones and then suddenly having flesh put on everything, right? That's kind of the exploratory journey that I've been on. I'm a very intuitive person, so I have a lot of intuitions about things, and I lead a pretty solitary life. And so it was really nice to come together with other people who were seeing the same things from their own perspective, you know, with their own life experiences, and then helping me to put flesh on my dry bones kind of thing, right? And as far as the journey towards orthodoxy, it's a start and stop kind of thing, because not that I'm not considering it. I just don't have any opportunity to actually participate because of where I live.
Yeah.
And so it's really been, Zoom meetings and private conversations with priests and inquiry and more inquiry and more inquiry. Mm-hmm. I think the only reason that I made the move towards orthodoxy was because I feel like I was already living in that space, and somehow it put a name on it for me.
It's fun because I very much remember my first. And Nate and I haven't had our first conversation yet, which is interesting. But with Michael and Sherry and Karen, I remember my first conversations with each of you. And, you all have such remarkable stories. And I said, Jim, one of the Jims from the Discord, I was on his podcast yesterday, and I often have the sense that the thing that gives me the most pleasure about what I've done over the last 4 years is watching not just the individual transformation, but the creation of these little communities. I mean, you're all making more videos than I could possibly have time to watch, and you're all taking them in different directions, and you're all finding new conversation partners. And I just watch all of these little communities and conversations and relationships grow. And of course, whereas I, there's no money in it for any of you. I know that there's been a little bit of money in this for me, but there's no money in this for any of you. And this is pure joy that you're doing this from. Yeah. And that joy is evident. And I think, as Nate said, the discovery. So, Karen, you were in some ways the first to really grab onto this hard, and you've had some success with your channel. Mm-hmm. And for you, I think you're probably, I want to be careful here. I think you're probably the oldest of the five of us.
By far.
Even if you don't look it, I always look older than I am. But you've had a tremendous amount of life experience. You've had some real highs and some real lows and some real dramatic turns. And I've watched you and what you've done with your channel. I mean, it's just been beautiful what I've seen you do. So I don't want to derail your first words, but I do have to say that I'm just amazed at what you've done with your channel and what you've been the part that you've played in the development of this strange network that has formed here.
Well, I mean, I think that for me, the greatest benefit, the greatest privilege has been to find a tribe. I mean, when I first got interested in Jordan Peterson, it was like my brain came alive again, because there had been a lot of things that I had been thinking about, but not articulating, because I had nobody to articulate them to. There's absolutely nobody that would have been interested in any of the ways that my mind thinks. And so I spent so much of my life reading junk. it's kind of scary. I was thinking about that this morning. I have the entire series of Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe mystery novels. I don't know if you've ever run across him. He was one of my favorites. I started reading him when I was in my 20s. There's probably 30 books. I read all 30 of them at least 4 or 5 times, just because it was one of the few things that I could read that was interesting to me, that was captivating, and that I could read and reread, but there's no substance to it whatsoever. And so I wasted all those years of reading when I could have been learning things. But part of it is, when you learn something, you want somebody to talk to about it. And if you've got nobody to talk to about it, you just feel like you're in a trap, right? So anyway, I started listening to Jordan Peterson, and that kind of woke up my brain. And I thought, I've got to do something with this. So when you challenged me, Paul, to start a channel, and people actually wanted to come on and talk, it was like, what a privilege is that? Mm-hmm. And then it sort of built itself. I didn't build anything. I mean, more and more people contacted me, or people would comment, and I would think, oh, like Michael, one of Michael's early comments. I just love this. I hope I don't diss on Michael, but I had a conversation with Alex, who works in geophysics. He's a geologist. And we were talking about things far outside our realm of expertise. He wasn't talking geophysics, and I wasn't talking anything I might know anything about. We were approaching some weird things that we were talking about. And Michael says in his comment, this is before I ever met Michael, he says, listening to the two of you talk about things that you don't know anything about actually opens a space for the rest of us to think about things in a new way.
Right.
And so I thought, well, now there's somebody I want to talk to. So that's how I got. I think I love Jordan Peterson's thing that the two, you can combine everything down into two things, that is gratitude and humility. And the humility side of it is, I know I don't know anything, but I have lots to learn, which means I can talk to a lot of interesting people. And gratitude is gratitude for all the people that I get to talk to. So,
yeah.
Well, you and Michael, really, you guys have had some amazing conversations, and, you know, quite a few. And so tell me about that relationship in terms of, what did you notice in each other that was productive and fruitful enough to keep pursuing it?
You want to go first, Karen?
No.
Well, it started, like Karen just pointed out, with that comment and subsequent comments, until I think we ended up, I don't even remember what our first conversation was about, honestly. I think for me, like, it was this, I similar to Karen, I've always had, like, just all kinds of strange and interesting ideas that are just like, that's like my daily, like, I spend probably too much time in my head thinking about things. And so, but suddenly I just saw that there was some real life in those things that could be explored. If you could find the intersection with somebody else, they could kind of help you sift out the real gems from the noise. And there was something about, like, again, watching her early conversations with Alex, where I just saw that, like, the sort of patience and love that they showed towards each other to kind of reach across these distances. And again, like, you know, areas that, like, they had some curiosity, but weren't experts in. It just, I felt like, I don't know. I just, something came alive there, and I wanted to be a part of it. And Karen has, you know, she's one of the things she's done really well with her channel is she's just created a sort of structure and a formatting that I don't think I've ever had a sort of disciplined approach in terms of my own kind of musings on things. So she was always intent on, you know, how she would drive things to some sort of interesting points that, like, on my own, I think I would kind of just do circles and, you know, kind of donuts in the parking lot, so to speak, where she always was kind of trying to take it up a layer. And I've always found that led me into places I wouldn't have gone otherwise in our conversations.
Yeah. She's really great at drawing things out of people. That's a real talent that Karen has. That's that I noticed, like, right away from the first time I talked to her. It's like, oh, I don't know if I would have just been able to come to that if Karen hadn't been here drawing it out of me.
Yeah.
So, and of course, Michael's the reason that Girl Country exists ultimately.
Really? Tell me that story.
Well, like, Michael, it's like, let's see, the first time I really, I didn't know it was Michael, but I had actually heard his interview with Mark Vernon without knowing him or who he was. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, I think the one that I saw
was a great interview,
which was fantastic. And he did a really good job. And I was very impressed with it. I didn't know it was him. It took me a while to put two and two together. But then I saw his conversation with Dr. DeFuscia. And, like, obviously Michael and I have a shared interest with Barfield. I know Barfield pretty well. He obviously knows Barfield very well. And so we had a little exchange in the comment section on that. And then it's like shortly after that, like, we ended up having a conversation on Radical Orthodoxy with Julian, which is, I think, was the first Randos video that I did. But, and he ended up inviting me to the little Voxer community that keeps getting mentioned now and again, to participate in that. And it was Michael that encouraged me, like, you know, you read all these books and you talk about all this stuff. I really think it would be beneficial if you started a channel. And I was like, I kind of agreed with him, but I knew that I wanted to talk to people about it. I didn't want to just monologue about the books that I was reading. It's like, no, I want to discuss these books with other people in dialogue and get other perspectives. And I kind of I kind of immediately knew it was Michael and Sherry that I wanted to discuss with. So, and then we later brought in, like, Jed has kind of joined us as kind of a regular fourth person now. Jed is somebody I've known from before, from our interactions on the David Bentley Hart fans community. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. He hasn't been on my channel either yet. So I should probably correct that too.
He's a really interesting guy. He's definitely worth your time.
Yeah.
Well, let's I mean, Karen mentioned Jordan Peterson, and in some ways that's sort of how this began, because I obviously got some visibility talking about Jordan. And, you know, what was it about Jordan that sort of broke open a bunch of things?
Well, you know, go ahead, Michael.
Okay, I'll be real brief, but there was a comment that Nate made in the conversation between Bervakey and Michael Martin that kind of stopped me in my tracks. And it was just kind of an offhand comment, but he talked about how in the comment, like, we don't think of philosophy as practical anymore. And there was something, and this relates to, I was me and Karen are going to have a conversation about Barfield coming up, completing his a bunch of stuff we've been doing on Speaker's Meaning, which is one of his shorter books and easier to go through. But there's a little comment in there where he talks about, you know, these certain taboos in terms of philosophy. Like, it's fine to have any sort of weird philosophical ideas you want. People will, you know, clap for you and, you know, you'll get published and everything, but you try and take those philosophical ideas and apply them in some real practical ways, and suddenly now you've crossed the line. And I think that's what it was. He was taking these two worlds and, you know, bringing them back together, which is something people have said, but that for me, that's continues to be what makes his work so interesting. He takes these two things that have become so separate and distinct in our modern, postmodern world, and he's brought them back together.
Well, just to connect that comment that I made to Barfield, it's like, to me, it's like the purpose of philosophy is to teach you learned ignorance so that you can enter back into participation. That's what it's, and that's what's practical. That's why it is practical. And that's what Socrates is trying to do to people. It's like, he's trying to teach them learned ignorance so that they can enter back into participation.
I like that, Nate.
I like that too.
Yeah.
How about you, Sherry? What do you think? What was it about Peterson that sort of broke this open for all of us?
Yeah. See, I think that what Michael said is really key, because I was going to say symbolos, which is bringing things together, right? So you know, it's like, for like, I can only relate how he affected me, right? And I was living in a, I pretty much live in a symbolic world. Like I've said before that for the longest time, I thought I didn't understand Jonathan Peugeot because everybody else said they didn't understand Jonathan Peugeot. And then I realized, wait a minute, I totally get what he's talking about. It took me a long time though.
Okay, sorry, I have to share a story. So the very, very first Jonathan Peugeot video I ever watched was his Of Course Santa Claus Exists video. And my reaction was laughter. And it's like, oh, maybe I'm not crazy. He's not the only person in the world who thinks like me. And I showed it to my son. And he's like, oh, that's exactly the speech you gave me when I was six. So I didn't have a problem understanding him. I was just like, it was sort of like validation. Oh, like the way I look at the world isn't totally insane. And I'm not a, just a weirdo. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I had like Jordan Peterson actually took Genesis and he did that to it. Right. Mm-hmm. He brought the symbolic and the literal together. And I hadn't seen it in the scripture. You know, to be honest, I hadn't seen that. And I could see the logos in the world, but I didn't see it brought together. And so when he did that, when he brought the two of them together, it was like a mushroom cloud, you know, just a big explosion in my head. And I was just, yeah, I just kept thinking, oh, well, it was just amazing to me. I just have really simple language for it. Like there's nothing, you know, it was just amazing to me. And then, you know, I've had crazy thoughts over the years of my life about things. And then I started thinking about my crazy thoughts in relationship to what I was just seeing and going, well, they're not actually that crazy. You know, and because I lived in a fairly narrow dialectic, like there was no conversation going on, I didn't share any of my ideas. And so coming into the Discord community or even YouTube comments in the beginning, it was like, oh, there's other people that I can talk to about this. And they also have similar ideas. And yeah, so it was personally confirming for me a lot of what I already knew. Which is what a lot of people say about Jordan Peterson. Right?
Yep.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's certainly what jumped out at me when I started listening to Jordan Peterson was finally somebody is talking about these things and in a way that other people can hear it and other people are interested in it, because I had that general big picture in my head that he was articulating there, just based on the trajectory of my life experiences and all the things that God had taught me in the midst of those things that happened to me were all the things he was talking about. But there were a lot of reasons I couldn't articulate those things to people. I mean, one of the reasons, first of all, is the minute you start talking about anything difficult and traumatic that has happened to you, people go into either sympathy mode or denial mode, or they want to run away. And so you can't really talk to them about, well, wait a minute, but I learned things in that space. And some of the things that I learned were things about myself that I didn't like. And the minute you start talking about that, people will go, oh, no, you're okay. You're great. You're just fine the way you are. And they don't want, you know, so there's no, you can't actually talk about it with anybody. Right. It gets shut off. And I think this goes to Michael and I are going to have this conversation about chapter 4 of Speaker's Meaning by Barfield. And one of the things he talks about in there is that it seems like in our modern world that whenever anybody gets, like he said, they can talk about a certain philosophical idea and it's just fine and dandy until they take it to its logical conclusion. And if you take it all the way to the end of its logical conclusion and you start to see things that are a little bit terrifying, you'll kind of jump. Like Michael said, maybe start doing wheelies in the parking lot because you don't want to face that logical conclusion. And so everybody always get right to the precipice and then they'll turn around and come back to where they were. And it makes it very hard to talk about things. But in our little corner, I think we give our set, we give each other space to actually come right up face to face to these things. I had a conversation with Chris Petkaw yesterday, and he's really good at asking questions. That
he is.
That
he doesn't beat around the bush at all.
Yeah, and asking
not
questions
even a little
that
bit.
Kind of went like I kind of inside. I'm kind of going, gosh, do I really want to answer that question? And then trying to suck it up and actually try to answer it and get somewhere. It was really an interesting experience.
No, it's true. That's Karen. That's you really articulated that well. Both the normal patterns that we're having in society, because you see that all the time as a pastor, that if someone expresses pain, I mean, the first thing people do when they see pain is they either want to distance themselves from it because it's too painful to be there, you know, to one way or another, resolve it and get it away from them. But to lean into it with a bit of courage is a rare thing. And yeah, I hadn't really noticed that about this community that has emerged, but that's true. And that's a really big deal.
Well, I think that's because of the connection to Peterson, because this is the number one thing about Peterson, who I have plenty of disagreements with. But the thing that I still love, the reason I still love Jordan Peterson is because Jordan Peterson does such a good job of modeling love in a proper way, mm-hmm. because he models love as a combination of accountability and care that is exactly right. And so it shouldn't be that surprising that people who were in a community that maybe began with a shared interest in Jordan Peterson like see that modeled and then find themselves wanting to at least attempt to act it out.
There's another point too that I think should be made is that he meets people in their suffering. Jordan Peterson does, right? Like that's actually where he's meeting people. And the fact is everyone is suffering. Mm-hmm. nobody's left out of that conversation, right? It's not for a certain group of people. And that's why it's so widely absorbed, let's say. I don't think it's widely accepted. There are people that don't like it, but because he's a psychologist, he's seen people suffer. And it seems to me that that's where he's meeting people and the interesting thing about that is that that's right where Christ meets us too.
Right. And the thing about what Peterson does with that suffering is that we have like people tend to say either suck it up or oh, you poor thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And what Peterson does is he tries to get people to recognize their own agency within the suffering and allows them to re-engage with the suffering with a renewed sense of agency.
You know, when Karen was
talking, I don't think it's just that. I think also he says, when you get to that precipice where the suffering is occurring, there are treasures to be found in the darkness.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right.
But you have to be able to encourage people, and I think encourage is the right word too, because that's what you're doing, is you're actually giving people the courage to face it so that they can see that.
Oh, that's really good.
Sorry.
No, that's, I'm just saying that's really good. Go ahead. Keep going, Sherry.
Sorry, Paul.
No, keep going.
I recently watched a video of a rescue dog. It was a guy who rescues animals. And this dog was, you know, mangy and full of parasites and dying in a dump. And it was curled up on a blanket in this dump. And the guy came along and he, you know, gently offered it some food and, you know, draped the leash over the dog and to get used to it, you know, and then eventually he could get the leash on the dog and he coaxed the dog up and the dog walked a few steps with him, but then it quickly turned in a circle and ran back to its bed, mm-hmm. right? Because it was dying and that was the only place that it found comfort. And
yeah.
sorry.
No.
And that's what Karen's example of people moving to the precipice and then running back. That's what it reminded me of.
I think the sin of our culture is this denial of death and suffering. And as a culture, we cover it with plastic and we hide it behind drapes. And there's this lie that we keep telling each other that Obama said it once really well, but not exactly in this way. You know, he's saying people did everything right and they're still suffering. And I thought, yeah. Yeah. Did you think that if you did everything right, according to whatever package of rightness has been sold to you, that somehow, this is very true of the church as well, somehow you would be exempt from the age of decay and the problems of this world? Who told you that lie? And I think the answer to that is we do. We tell each other that lie. And the most powerful influence machine that the world has ever created propagates that lie for the sale of shampoo, cosmetics, and cars. This is the world we're living in. And Peterson, in a sense, you know, had, you know, the temerity to say, yeah, Black folks and gay folks and all of those folks are suffering. They're victims. And who else isn't? We're all victims. And I think you're right, Nate, that he approached that and said, okay, you're a victim. What are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Because the answer to your victimhood is agency, but not in the cheap plastic solution sense that we have advertised and promote, that somehow if you grab your agency, then your suffering will end, usually at the expense of the perpetrator. No, that doesn't work either. And so agency is the answer, is an answer.
Right. And yeah. And where I would probably begin to disagree with Peterson and think he falls short, although sometimes I think he starts to get there, is that ultimately the proper use of that agency is the realization of the true imago Dei, which is to emulate the kenosis of your creator. This is why I think Pajot, as much as I like him, I really think he missed the boat on David Lowery's Green Knight film, because I actually think that film was about kenosis, and it withheld the obvious promise of resurrection, because that's how it actually works. It's like you ultimately have to face the axe. Like you have to face that death, and you have to just trust in your creator that there is something else. That's why to me that question that the Green Knight asks in that penultimate scene, what else should there be? That's not a cynical question at all. That's a very, very real and profound question that we don't get to find out until we cross the threshold.
Yeah. One of the things that people would often say to me when I talk to them about the crucifixion and resurrection would be, well, geez, it wasn't so courageous for Jesus to die because he knew that the Father would raise him. You know, even if they are skeptical about the resurrection, they just said within the story, that's true. But the answer to that is, but Jesus hadn't seen anyone else come out of the tomb. We have. So what's our excuse?
We also don't know if the divine and the finite mode really can be properly said to have the same access to the divine when it's in the infinite mode. Right. So that like,
this so is there's why like, you're the esoteric group.
But like, there may be a way in which like Jesus may genuinely within his finite human incarnation may not have known. Like there's a kenosis involved in the incarnation itself, not just in the death. So his actual death is the ultimate final full kenosis, right? But even the incarnation itself is a canonic act on the part of the divine. It's a it's a self-limitation of the divine. So Jesus may not have necessarily known, like, which, even though he prophesied it, even though he, right, exactly.
Go ahead, Nate. Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, like, in light of what he was just saying, read Psalm 22, which he quotes from the cross, right? That I think read that imaginatively as sort of, and it's both in there. It's like he has the full descent into death in that psalm, but there's also sort of the resurrection in the psalm as well. And I don't know, there's something very, very key, like, that we're talking about here with suffering. And I was just the other day, I was watching this, it just came up on my YouTube feed, like a tourist video for Poland. And it's like, here's the top 10 places to go through Poland. And of course, in the middle of it, it goes to Auschwitz. And I just started crying out of nowhere. Like, I mean, it was immediate. And I think I told you this the first time we talked, Paul, that, like, that was part of my transformation in coming here. Was up until that point in my life, I hadn't really paid attention to those moments. And then I suddenly decided to take it serious and pay attention when that happened. And somehow, like, I realized, you know, obviously I'm crying in some sense for the horror of Auschwitz and seeing those physical buildings and experiencing in a way that you can only experience when you're looking at, like, this is a real place that I can go visit, and kind of having the force of that hit me, that it's not just a story. But that it suddenly, at the same token, I just had this other thing hit me, and I can't explain why it hit me simultaneously. It was the fact that Auschwitz is real, in some sense, tells me that the resurrection is real too. Mm. And I don't know how those two are intertwined, but there's something about the two that, again, read Psalm 22, but that the two are interlinked in some deep and profound ways that we don't have very good words to articulate. And I think Peterson is trying to articulate that in what he's doing.
Well, I mean, simplify all the deep philosophical things you guys just said with my dog story.
Yeah,
you know, right. The dog is dying on the bed. He's laying in death, right? And his opportunity to move into the unknown, which is for him death. The death that he's in is a known thing. He knows it. And it brings him a comfort. He's on a soft blanket, right? And that movement with this stranger into the unknown is death for him. But it's all the opposite, right? If he gets up and moves with the stranger into the unknown, he moves into life. If he stays on his bed, he dies.
Or remains dying.
And he has to empty himself, right?
Yeah.
Of all his fear of the unknown to go with that stranger into the unknown. That's what you just all said.
Yeah, I mean, that I'm glad you brought them back from the precipice, Sherry, because I always tell people, I have a very simple mind. And when we got to this question, what came into my head was when Nate brought up kenosis, what came to me was Peterson's insistence that if you tell the truth, that which comes about is good, regardless of what the consequences may look like. Now, one of the questions that Chris Petcaw asked me yesterday, and I don't even remember what the question was, but I remember it left me with a hole where I thought I understood something and I don't understand it. So I want to ask all you guys this question, okay? I've been wrestling with the whole idea of reality for quite a while, with this idea that Jesus himself is the shape of reality. Mm-hmm. And that when we come into alignment with Christ, maybe this answers my question here. When we come into, when we come into alignment with Christ, we begin to take on his shape, and that process is a lot of peeling away things from us as we're going through that process. It's that kenosis thing, right? Getting rid of all the stuff. But the way it actually looks in life is you're walking along and you make a decision. I think Jonathan Peugeot often uses the example of, why did I eat that second piece of cake? Because when you first eat the cake, it doesn't look like there's any consequence to it, but it catches up with you down the road, right? Because you can't twist the fabric of reality and not have it snap back at you. The things that we do that are not true in the carpenter sense of lining up with the plumb line have a way of snapping back at us. So we find out the truth of what we're doing based on the consequences that we experience. So it would sound as though that is saying that when you do the right thing, everything will turn out okay. But it's actually not like that, right? Because Christ did everything right, but where did he end up?
Right.
You know? Right.
And when you speak the truth, oftentimes you're going to end up in a deep, deep pile of doo-doo. Like Michael brought up Auschwitz, and that's one of the things that Peterson often talks about, is that the reason that the Nazis took hold is that ordinary people did not speak the truth when the moment arose. Because if they had spoken the truth, the consequences would have been just terrible for them and their families, and yeah, too terrifying to look at. And all around me, I see this way of thinking in people, even people that I love and admire. They'll always say, well, it's just, you know, in this situation, we should trust this group and just do what they say. Even if there may be reasons to be looking more deeply into what they're saying, and I'm not talking about the big V word right now, I'm talking about other things. But I mean, it comes up often that you hear people that you love and admire, and I myself do it. I did it for many years. I kept my mouth shut about things because I didn't want to drive away all my friends. But we can't do that anymore. You know, it's just gotten too critical for that. And yet, how are we going to strengthen one another to be ready to walk into what that final consequence is? I don't know. It's kind of scary to think about. Well, it's terrifying to think about, actually. And yet we know that Christ will be with us. So,
well, that is the image of Christ, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when you conform to that image, you're conforming to death and suffering.
Well, it will. I tell people, if you live like Christ, you will die like Christ, and you will be raised like Christ. I mean, that's the package. And I think this is something that I'm always sort of living between Peugeot and Julian. And so Julian, you know, Julian popped in, and Julian, of course, the Anabaptist, and, you know, to a certain degree, Nate, the anarchists, you know, this is Jesus is a revolution, but no, Jesus is a counter-revolution. But there is, you have to, in terms of the Peugeotian worldview, you have to take seriously that there is a master of the present age. And so aligning yourself perfectly with reality in this present age will get you what Jesus got. And that's a key message of the gospel, that sometimes the one side doesn't.
Because this present reality is not in line with the real, because the real is in accordance with the good.
Right.
And this present reality is still under the control of principalities and powers. So if you're conforming to what this world sees as the real, it's actually the unreal. Right. That you're conforming yourself to.
And that's the word of the anarchists and the Anabaptists in this space, which is something that the, you know, for Constantine, for Constantinople, for kingdom come, and, you know, kingdom came in Rome and Constantinople, and yet it didn't. And that's something that Christians continue to have to wrestle with.
Because we were still looking for the kingdom in the wrong place. Yeah. That's
what I mean. I think that story is represented in the shedding of the skin of a snake or any reptile, you know, that's what that phenomenon tells me, you know, the snake has a beautiful skin and continues in his life, and he grows slightly and he gets too big for his skin and he has to shed it. And then, and you know, so Jess and I talk about this all the time, this U-shaped journey, this death, birth, death, and resurrection, right? And that's the image of Christ, birth, death, and resurrection. And so we will constantly be shedding our skins. We will constantly be dying and being born again, right? Yeah. And that is what this life is for. I mean, Michael and Nate know that I have this body question. And it's a really banal question,
it's not really a banal question. It's a very, very good question.
We'll give it. I mean, let's hear it, Sherry.
Well, it sounds banal because I just say, well, what is the body for? And I remember throwing that out on the Discord the first time, and all I got back was like Gnostic pies in the face, you know? It's like, wait, that's not what I'm talking about, you know? And the more I think about it with my community of people, because they really help me to think about it, the more I realize how actually integral it is to this U-shaped journey that we're in, right? This birth and death and resurrection, like, and it's fractal, because we're not just a part of we're not just a body, but we're part of a body, right? And so it plays itself out over and over and over again. It's just everywhere I look, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when Karen was saying about this, you know, aligning with the image, right, of Christ, that's what I took away from Verveke's reaching for the cup, right? He talks about reaching for a cup and conforming. And what I find really interesting about that is that, because Jesus said, if you seek, you will find, right? And so that's the reach. That's the reach, the seek. And as you do that, you conform automatically, like Verbeke points out. You're not conscious of the confirmation to the cup. You just end up conforming, right? And that's why Jesus can say, if you seek, you will find.
Yeah, yeah.
So the snake is outgrowing the skin, and the skin gets shed, and then the snake grows up into the skin again, mm-hmm. and then outgrows the skin. And then, okay, so that's the picture that we have in the scripture of growing up into Christ.
Yeah.
Right? We are growing up into him as he grows up into us. I mean, it also says that, which I've always found the most fascinating thing. So it's almost like, I saw a picture once that was an illustration once of us being like a glove. Christ grows up into us and we grow up into, so the glove doesn't have any power of its own. The glove's power comes from what the glove is filled with and being, and the glove takes on the shape of the hand that moves into it. And also is somehow conformed to the environment around it, almost like the snake skin. Although I do like the picture of myself being the snake instead, growing and growing. You know, it's much nicer to think about myself growing than just being shed off. But I mean, there are things about me that are just being shed off. Okay. So, but I was thinking back to what Nate said earlier about the purpose of philosophy being to teach you learned ignorance so that you can enter back into participation. And when he said that, what popped into my mind is that scripture that the law is a schoolmaster to teach us our need of Christ, because it's the law that teaches me my learned ignorance, teaches me what I can't achieve, teaches me where I can't get on my own, so that I know that I need to be conformed to Christ instead of, so.
Right. And that's because being a Christian ultimately isn't a doing, it's a being. So that's why, I mean, that's why you can't. You can't, I mean, it's like, I don't know how, but I really, words start to fail at that level, but I think you follow what I mean. I mean, it's like, it's not, yeah, it's but, a being.
But what is, you, what is how, being?
The telos of being is doing.
Yes. What is being if it isn't connected?
Specifically, it's, well, it's love actually.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, so that's, I mean, and my answer to the action. Body prop. My yes, yes, absolutely. It sure is. And God is the unmover because he is the motion that is love that moves everything. But Sherry, your body problem to me, it's like, I've never been able to successfully answer it either. But the best answer I have to it is that we have a body that because we are created in the image of God, which who is love. And it is that. So we have a body that may be manifest to the lower levels of being.
Well, I think I almost answered it this morning in the Voxer.
I haven't heard that yet.
Oh, in the Voxer. Boy, would Luke be happy if I jumped on that Voxer.
He would.
Well, let me, so Jordan Peterson sort of kicked this thing off, but about a year or so into this, Strawn from South Africa, you know, would pester me, said guy got my email address early on and writes me often and listens to all my videos, even though I haven't had a chance to get him on the channel, not for lack of trying. You know, and then he brought Verveke to the fore. And of course, Verveke had his Buddhism and cognitive science class that the sound was horrible, but that's what Strawn kept throwing at me. And then of course, John, with some collaboration of some students, started doing Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. You know, Peugeot had a conversation with John, Benjamin Boyce had, and it was very interesting because when I sort of first started bringing John into the conversation, especially in an appreciative mode, the reaction immediately was pretty hostile. But now after a couple of years, John's, you know, thick as thieves in this little corner of the internet. So what's his role been?
Anybody want to tackle that first?
Well, I think obviously, here's how I see it. I see him as, for me at least, he shows how far, because in a certain sense, he's, it seems to me in watching your conversations, in some real sense, he is standing within the Christian fold in some real ways. And he's, to me, he's showing how much larger that circle actually is. Mm-hmm. And also, and this is funny too, because John is so much about, to a certain degree, he's so much about the propositions and getting them right. And yet many of his propositions I don't agree with, and yet I still, in watching him, especially like that the most recent conversation you two had, he's doing something, he's being something that is essentially Christian, in spite of, you know, not having the quote-unquote correct propositions. And so that's, there's something that I think we're all learning by being a witness to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that as far as I can tell, the only thing that John and I might actually have any kind of real disagreement on is the resurrection. But I guess that, I mean, other than that, I think, I mean, we both have a very Neoplatonist sort of framework for looking at things. So we have like a lot of intersection. There's one thing that I was, and that really great conversation, last conversation he had with Paul, when he, there was one thing I wish that I could have been there to say to him. I don't know, when he was talking about like feeling like you would have to need to give up Spinoza and Siddhartha, when he was saying that in that conversation, I'm like, but like, John, hasn't it occurred to you that Christ is the form of man? You know, I'm wondering if like, if putting it in that kind of like Neoplatonic language, which I think is correct too. I mean, that's like, I think that's theologically correct. So I wouldn't just be saying it. I wonder if that would make him think about it differently, but you know, the resurrection's another matter altogether. I mean, ultimately that's like, I think that's the thing that makes you either ultimately a Christian or something else.
So says First John.
Right.
Well, I think that's really helpful in that. Oh shoot, I lost it. I just had it. there's a reluctance. The irony. I loved what you just said, Michael, about the propositional, because there's a deep irony in there that, you know, both Peterson and Vervaeke lately have been, you know, oh, there's too much propositional. And I agree. And whenever I say that, I get in trouble with Tripp and Esther. But that is in a sense the correcting of the overreach of modernity, that the proposition has its place and it needs to stay in its proper place within the rest of Vervaeke's four P's. Yet there's a resistance against the definitive. And, you know, I noticed that also in Peugeot's conversation with, you know, one of the authors that he had, that when Peugeot would kind of lean into that, you know, Christ is the story, and the resistance is that, well, that Christ's story will limit us. And I think it's exactly the opposite, that in fact, the reason we see Christ figures in movies all over the place is not because that story limits us, but rather that story is the productive seed that actually gives birth to, you know, stories from now on.
Well, take what I said about Christ as the form of man. It shows you what the actual potential of humanity is. That's like it's shown in Christ.
Yeah.
That's not a limitation.
No.
At all.
And let's just point out that we are called the body as Christians, right?
Yeah.
The form of man.
Right.
Humanity is the body. That is the form. And thus my question.
Yes. So I got to thinking about this morning, Sherry, because I just happened to see coming across my Twitter feed, Peterson had posted a little snippet of a conversation he had with Dan Crenshaw. And in that conversation, Peterson is making the point that there is an almost infinite diversity of personality types, because even though there are the five big personality types, they each have two subsections and each person is somewhere along the trajectory from one to the other. And so if you add up all these intersections, you get every individual is diverse from every other individual. And he was making the point, he didn't make it explicitly, that this is the value of distributed cognition. This is where we get different ways of looking at things. And this is why free speech is necessary, so that we can solve problems so they don't become catastrophes. But I got thinking about, I've been thinking about this for a long time, how there are so many different personality types that they're capable of doing all the jobs that come up in the world. You know, there's some people that actually prefer to be garbage men because it gives them freedom with their time. And there's people that like to do carpentry work, and there's people that like to be computer scientists and poets and, you know, every single kind of person you can imagine. How can that be something that just arises evolutionarily? You know, I mean, we have the picture of it in the Bible when you talk about the body. Some are toes, some are hands, some are arms, some are probably biochemical processes in the pathways that lead to metabolic something or other, you know. Everybody is a part of the body and all are necessary for the whole form to work together. But I don't see how evolution can account for that infinite diversity. I mean, I don't see how evolution can account for any of the things it says it accounts for, but that one particularly stuck out to me. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you guys a question, a bigger question. I mean, when you brought up Vervaeke, it made me think about this. Michael, you said that Vervaeke's actions and his ideas and his actions show him to be within this realm of what it means to be a Christian. that goes back to when C.S. Lewis talks about the contraction of the meaning of Christian from the beginning. Because originally, well, maybe it's an expansion of meaning. Originally, Christian meant someone who decided to follow Christ. But over time, Christian came to mean someone who acts in a certain way. And so then to say that someone was not a Christian became a pejorative during a certain period of history, even though they may not have wanted to be someone who follows Christ, but you would be saying to them, you'd be saying about them, basically, you're not behaving in a certain way.
Yeah, we would secularly talk about people doing the Christian thing.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And that would be a totally secular phrase that was normal to use.
So when you think about actions, and here's an action has an inside and an outside. An action has both a reason and it has a consequence, right? So actions having reasons and consequences, you have to think about what are the reasons that led to that action. And I know in my own life, I had this big debate with Hyun Shu on Twitter about what's the real meaning of fake it till you make it. If you think of it in the Petersonian world, it has a slightly different meaning than the way people usually talk about fake it till you make it. But you can do an action even if your reason is wrong, but this is one of those questions that's really hard to ask because it has so many implications, and I'm afraid. I'm going to say it anyway. If you do an action, even though your reasons are wrong, funny enough, you're not allowed to say certain things, isn't it? I mean, I'm just stopped right here. Let me try to phrase it a different way. If my reasons for doing something are to pump myself up or to make myself feel important or to make me look a certain way in terms of other people, do I get credit for that in the same way that I would get credit for that if my action were based solely out of my love for Christ?
Mm. I hear what you're saying, Karen, and I would
now
say
this is not in reference to Pravaiki at all.
Right, no, this is what I would say.
Right.
What I would say is that you will never do the good for its own sake if you don't do the good for whatever reason you're doing it for, right?
So you'll never make it, right,
exactly. You'll never get to the point where you're doing the good for its own sake if you're not actively practicing doing the good.
And is
present themselves to you.
Is that because from Paul's Calvinist viewpoint, I'm incapable of having the right reasons for doing something?
Well, let me
right, Paul? Okay.
let me just say this, because this is actually what I said in the Boxer this morning, Nate, that I referred to before. In cognitive behavioral therapy, you have the triangle of, you know, behavior, thoughts, and feelings. And the hardest thing to change are your feelings, okay? So the first thing, the easiest thing to tackle in that triangle is your behavior. That's something you can do, right? So it's like when you're a kid and your dad says, take out the garbage, and you don't want to, but you can do it. You can do that. So you do it. And so and what happens when you do that is that it changes your thoughts. Oh, this isn't so bad, right? And then when that happens, it changes your feelings. That's how you get to the feelings, by the action. And so Lance and I were talking about rigor and practices and the body, okay? And so you engage the body, right, in a practice. And when you do that, it changes your thoughts, which is your mind. And to me, this triangle is repentance. This is what repentance is. Okay. So what you're doing is you are engaging in a practice and you are renewing your mind, because that's what repentance means, metanoia. It's a renewing of your mind. Okay. And then it changes your feelings, which is where you can love. Okay, we were talking about monastics who talk about even being careful about a sideways glance at someone, because you can influence someone else in the room by doing that, right? And that could lead to someone's destruction. And then you would be responsible. Like, so you need to love always, all the time, all things. And so how do you do that? Well, you engage in practices, in rigor with your body. And in doing so, you are repenting, right? You are renewing your mind. And then you can love perfectly.
Yeah. And you know, again, one of the most lovely things about what has happened is the community around the Discord server. So, you know, I've gotten a chance to know Lance a little bit. But of course, Lance comes, like Chad, from the recovery community. And it's the recovery community that, you know, really majors in fake it till you make it in this sense. Stop drinking. Yeah. You're only going to experience metanoia if you stop drinking. The behavior comes first. And then, of course, the community is there to support. You don't have the feelings yet. You don't believe it yet. You don't have any of that strength yet. So the community is going to come around you and lend you its agency until that agency finally grows in you. But then, of course, you have to, within the community, continue to lend that agency back into the pool of the community. And then as a group, then together, the agency of the body grows. And many more are rescued and can then continue the process. And that is edification in the New Testament term about how the body is built up.
Yeah, I'm continually amazed at the people that I meet who have participated in recovery programs in a very active way. The degree of spiritual wisdom and insight that these people consistently have, and how much they get it on a level that may not be an intellectual propositional level, but just that they just understand how to properly conform their pattern of being in the way that they ought to. It's pretty astounding, actually.
Yeah. In a very non-esoteric way. Because if anybody's anti-esoteric, it's Chad the alcoholic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, they see that principle of engaging, right, the practices. Like I think Chad said once, you always know someone who's not doing the work in AA. If they're not doing the work, they're not getting anywhere. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, good, good. So where do we want to see this thing go? I mean, we struggle to even figure out what this thing is or how we've gotten here, but we have done a lot of work to bring it where, I mean, and that's part of the reason I picked the four of you, because I'm not creating a hierarchy and say that you've worked more than others, but I've seen your work, and that's not necessarily a fair metric to use. So my apologies to those who feel excluded, but what's next? You know, I think we're going to continue in the practices that we have begun, but what do we hope for from this work that we have engaged in?
Well, I can say my answer is easy, Paul. To the moon. That's where I'm going.
Say a little more.
Well, seek and ye shall find, right? So to me, that is a constant pattern. I don't think that I'm ever going to arrive anywhere. I'm just going to just keep going further up and further in.
Okay. Okay. Because I remember our first conversation, Sherry, and that powerful story you told of, you know, basically God pushing you down. And, you know, you were, you know, you were upset and angry. And, you know, that that's not the kind of thing that I think our culture would like to imagine God does, but our culture has become quite biblically ignorant because people, I always tell people, don't play chicken with God, because God will do things that you consider to be irresponsible or even downright evil in order to achieve what it is he wishes to achieve. And so you will not win. You will not win a battle against him. So the sooner we figure that out, the better in some ways it goes for us.
Well, I mean, you know, he did break Jacob's hip.
Yeah.
Had a little wrestling match. So
he
didn't mind that. He doesn't mind that too much.
No. And he, and the cross, I mean, what's amazing about the Christian story is that even Islam today looks at that and says, well, God would never do that. God would never go to such lengths. God would never allow such humiliation. So Jesus might have been a great prophet, but he certainly was not the Son of God. And he certainly was not, he certainly did not lose to the Romans in such a public, such a public, dehumanized, brutal way. Mm-hmm. But Christianity, you know, lets that stand. And Tom Holland's recent talk on Unbelievable about Christian persecution made the point that he's made in other comments where, you know, it took Christianity nearly 400 years to sort of come to terms with that, and could only kind of do so after crucifixions were sort of taken off the table. It's almost an idea that was so appalling that even the church looked at it and said, I'm not sure we want to go there. But it's obviously what Paul says to the Corinthian church, that I'll have no other ground of boasting save this. Mm. So it's a big deal.
Well, it certainly gives new meaning to love conquers all, right?
Yeah. And how, and any of us, you know, especially I think those of us who are parents, and I think especially mothers, know just what love requires. I mean, we treat it so shallowly, so naively in our culture, but just what love requires. I mean, every woman that brings a child into this world does so at the risk and sometimes the cost of her life. And any good mother or good parent, for that matter, you know, fills their children with humanity and agency at the cost of their attention and time and money and life. That's this world. And so to save the world, this is right out of the Heidelberg Catechism, to save the world, you would need a sacrifice of such magnitude, which is, again, part of the reason why I can't be a Unitarian, because he must also be God as well as man. So what do we want from this thing, guys? Are we satisfied? Sherry wants more. Can we say what more we want?
I'm personally trying to do the best that I can to try to build up community that kind of like tries to, you know, live out some of the same principles. I've got my little local estuary. We had a COVID outbreak, so we had to go online our last time, but through Zoom. But I can see it making a difference. I mean, it's the group isn't that big yet. And I don't know how big I want it to get. It gets to a certain point where it, you know, diminishing returns. But I can see that, like, I can actually see it's made a profound difference for some of the people that are involved already. So I already know it's doing, you know, it's doing good. So, and then I would say in the very, very short term, we're getting talking about God and victory. Sherry and I are getting ready to have a conversation with some other folks on the apocalypsis of the fallen spirits. So later this afternoon.
Further up and further in, Nate.
Yeah.
There's a weird, so Peugeot, well, for one, about Estuary, you know, I watched that Babylon Bee Elon Musk conversation, and I released a video this morning about the end of it, where, you know, they sort of mockingly asked Elon if he'd take Jesus as their savior. And so the commentary is in that video. But I looked at Musk and I listened to him, and I thought, even a guy who has billions of dollars, his own rocket program, his own supercar program. I mean, Elon Musk is the Tony Stark of our age. And when I listened to him talk with the Babylon Bee guys, I could hear that probably even Elon Musk would long for a group, an estuary group, where he could come and explore and have questions and, serious conversation about the things that matter.
Oh, I agree. I think we just grossly underestimate the degree to which people are starving for conversation. They don't even necessarily know that it's possible to have these kinds of conversations. Yeah. And they don't need to happen at a super high, like, intellectual level. These conversations are deeper than that, because they touch on experiences that are universal. And everyone is going to have insight and bring something to it from wherever they're at.
The other thing that I commented this morning, Peugeot on Twitter noted that they're up to 10 million views on his channel. And I thought, I was surprised by how low that number was, actually, because my channel is about 4.3 million. And with 20,000 subscribers, whereas Peugeot has about 140. And so I asked him, I said, what do these numbers mean? And I think a lot of, you know, what you just said, Nate, about the size of your groups, small is beautiful. And people will sometimes, oh, your channel should be bigger. I'm really, you know, there's a degree of conflict, obviously, in there, but I'm really glad my channel isn't bigger. And I'm really glad that, you know, so Jordan Peterson, in a sense, had to take his status rocket ride. And there's a cruciform element to that. Because what we're able to do right here and right now, I think, is so precious and so foundational that, on one hand, you know, I'd love to see Meaning Code and Grail Country and the Discord just, you know, have numbers in keeping with what I think it's worth. Yet I'm so glad it is not so large and has not scaled, so that we can talk face to face, and I can know something. You know, Nate, this morning I saw that video of your mother singing, and I was subscriber number 33, and I couldn't be more proud. You know, it's so, here's Nate's mom, and, you know, I've met Karen's daughter, and hopefully our West Coast estuary tour will get up to BC, and I'd love nothing more than to see Sherry's farm animals, and I want to see Michael's family, because it's in these real things that size tends to prohibit, mm-hmm. and block. Hierarchies bind and blind, they always do. And so, you know, I really, even though Chris and Grim and Chad, they have all these tiny little numbers that might get them discouraged, or Grail Country might get discouraged, I don't want you to be, because I want you to treasure the smallness and the intimacy, because I really believe that's where the power is. Because again, this agency gets transmitted and seeded face to face, eye to eye, one at a time. When, you know, human women don't have litters. And that's key for us. So there's my speech.
No, yeah,
that's great, Paul. I mean, honestly, I'm like immensely grateful that that I stumbled across you, and that you encouraged the growth of this community, right? In the way that you handled everything, and you know, all these little channels like Karen and Nate and Chad and Chris and Grim and
there's lots of them.
You know, they're a net.
Don't forget James, who we've talked to several times.
Yes, and James, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They're a net, right? We're all connected to each other, and you know, we kind of encapsulated as this little corner of the internet kind of thing. But it's also something that carries us.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it does for me anyway.
Well, thinking about Paul's comment that hierarchies bind and blind, one of the things that I would like to see our little communities do is not that we have to grow in numbers, but that that, like you said, this ability, I have this light in my this ability that we have to actually speak honestly with each other is something that so many people are hungry for, even people that are high up on hierarchies. And I would like those people who are high up on those hierarchies to get a glimpse of this. Mm-hmm. That would be my goal, I guess, because I last week or a couple of weeks ago, I watched this conversation between Gregory Chaitin and Stephen Wolfram. Chaitin's a famous mathematician, I guess, and Wolfram, of course, is a physicist and a mathematician. And they're talking, they're grappling for something. You can hear them in their conversation. They're looking for, they know there's something that is an answer to their questions. But the minute they get close to having to talk about the God thing, they just jump and run someplace else because they know what it would do to their followings. They know what it would do to their careers. They know what it would do to their presuppositions about everything.
Yeah.
And I hear that in so many conversations now. Lex Friedman had a conversation the other day with this guy named Peter Wang, who's some kind of CEO of something. I don't know. He's famous for something, or Lex Friedman wouldn't be talking to him. And this guy starts talking about, you know, well, let's just do a thought experiment. Not to say that I believe this or think this is the way it is, but what if it were this way? They always have to couch everything that way because there's so much fear.
Yeah.
I would like what we're doing to become at least enough well-known to people could come to understand that there is no fear in love, right? Mm-hmm. That perfect love drives out the fear. If we're loving one another properly, then we should be able to talk about anything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very true, Karen. And I think that's like one of the things that like I've started trying to do is to try to bring people together from different disciplines and try to get them to talk to each other. I first had the idea of trying to get John to talk to David Bentley Hart because I know John already reads David and has a respect for his work. And that was supposed to happen in November, but then David had some kind of like health problem come up in his family. So he put that out. He says he wants to still have the conversation, but he's going to wait until his new book on consciousness comes out. Cause that's what I wanted to have him talk about was consciousness, because John's a cognitive scientist and David writes a lot about consciousness. So there would be a lot for them to talk about there. Yeah. But I ended up bringing him together with Michael Martin, who's like, you know, like a philosopher, a theologian and a writer who has a religious perspective. I thought that him and John could have an interesting conversation. So that was kind of like my fallback, but we need to have people having those conversations like that are where you have people talking cross discipline.
Yeah.
Because scientists are bad at philosophy generally. John's an exception.
Yeah.
John's an exception. He's very rare. Yeah. To have a scientist who actually has that good a grasp on philosophy is extremely unusual. Mostly they just like get themselves into trouble when they wade into those waters. So it's good to have cross-discipline conversations.
Well, and one of the things that happen when you get these guys that are high up on the hierarchy talking to each other is that they each have their own world inside their heads, and they don't have space in there to let the other guy's world in. So when they start talking, one of them's just doing a brain dump and then the other one's doing a brain dump. Yep. And it's very little like this, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But when you saw the third conversation or fourth conversation between John Verbeke and Jordan Peterson, they finally started to get each other enough to where there could be something happening. I think I would love to see more of that kind of longer communication, or the alternative would be like what you're doing, Nate, where if you can be the intermediary and kind of help somebody, like I can see this connection between Jordan Peterson and Stephen Wolfram. It's in my brain. So perfect. But if they talk to each other, they wouldn't have the first idea of what to talk to each other about. Unless there was somebody in the middle that said, here's what this guy thinks and here's what this guy thinks. And that's where your connections are.
I front loaded a lot of the work in that in my framing of the conversation too, because it's like, I saw an immediate connection between the two of them through Goethe. So it's like, okay, so I want to make this conversation about the Goethean approach to science, because that immediately gives a point of connection. Yeah. Because both of you talked about Goethe and thought about Goethe's approach to science. So there's a thing that we can frame the conversation around to kind of get the pump primed. And the same thing with the idea of him and David talking about consciousness, because I know that like they both have a lot to say about that. And it's an almost inexhaustible topic. And the conversation would definitely flow pretty freely, I think.
Michael, you haven't had a chance. I mean, people are pretty aggressive. I don't know if you wanted to jump in.
I think everybody's articulating well what I'm hoping for as well. I mean, that same kind of visual element of like a net. I keep seeing that, and the net is in some real sense formed out of love. I mean, I got that as a really strong visual when I was listening to your conversation with John Verbeke, that one, the most recent one that I thought was really good. And it was like this sense of like, you know, someone who's able to stay where they're rooted, like they're rooted and grounded in a certain place, and they're able to reach out to and make real contact and an accommodation for the other without necessarily having to give up that rooted spot. And I was seeing that kind of form as like these sort of nets of connections. And, you know, I do hope that some of this gets to be an in-person thing as well at some point too. Like we have opportunities, you know, here with maybe COVID, maybe Omicron is COVID burning itself out, and we can do some of this in person. That would be really phenomenal. But I do think, yeah, there's something of a, you know, we talked a lot about ideas, but for me, like all the transformational stuff always comes and shines through in the personal elements where the abstract becomes concrete, you know, is in the person. And when people start really kind of, you can always see the passion, right? When people are talking about these abstract ideas, there's some reason why they're so passionate about this, but when it kind of shines forth of like they're in their story, like, you know, I want to see more of that and be a part of it, helping, you know, be part of the love that helps make it possible.
I think what's particularly powerful, Michael, is when those two things collide, when people are like able in conversation to see where the ideas intersect with the stories and inform each other.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cherry.
I'm going to hint at something. It's a project that I've been working on with some people from the Discord for about a year now. And we're getting to the final stages, and it'll be something that people can hold in their hands, and it'll be a community effort. And I think that those things are, you know, if you have a little imagination, which I have like way too much of, you can think about those kinds of things too. Because when I think about that, doing something, a project like that, it's like, it's hands reaching out and holding on to something that connects them even further together, right?
Yeah.
And it'll be something too that can be shared with people outside of the community. So
good. I can't wait to see what you guys do.
Yeah, it's going to be a little while yet, but I'll just leave it at that. It's a big secret. So.
And I want to throw this out here too. I have space in my house that we could have meetings and small group meet. We could have large group meetings for as many as 35 and small group meetings for like five different small groups out of that. I'm more than happy to set up something where we have a get together of some kind and even try to find some place where there's reasonable housing. If anybody's interested in doing that kind of thing, like in maybe, let's say June or something, when the weather clears up and COVID is gone.
Yes. Yes. No, that sounds, and you're not that far away from me. So that's a very real thing.
I don't know how far I am away from Nate. I know Sherry's a long ways away, but, and where, I was going to say Michael comes here for work occasionally, but not anymore, huh?
Oh,
because you have different work now.
Now it's Seattle. So maybe I'll be able to see Nate.
Well, yeah. So I've got a daughter in Seattle now. I've got a son in Santa Cruz. And I do want to do another retreat that I did at my sister's. So my sister has a big old farmhouse, and she has a kind of like an Airbnb. Yeah. There was a totally different mix of people that's not on my videos, that we spent 2 days just in lovely old living rooms with my sister keeping us fed with things, and just 2 days of free flow conversation with about a dozen strangers. And it was lovely. I do want to do more of those things. But of course, COVID sort of shut a lot of that down, but I think we will do that. I do want to say, though, to Karen's point, that one of the things, I mean, hierarchies do bind and blind, and your point about if Wolfram and Jordan Peterson talked, or if Peterson and Elon Musk talked, those conversations are regularly disappointing, because of course, both people are too far up a hierarchy to actually devote attention and love the opposite way. And so, for example, with the Four Horsemen video, it was clear to me that Vervaeke and Peugeot, who have done conversation together, that there it's not so much where the person sits in a particular hierarchy that will create the productivity or the pleasure or the agency or the brilliance or the glory in any of these things. A lot of it has to do, again, back to the attention, the time, the love. And I think it's for that reason that, as you said, Sherry, this network that we are building is so fruitful and so powerful. I made a point in last Sunday's sermon. Tiny little groups of well-knit together people change the world, good and bad. I mean, Peterson was talking about Antifa, what, 800 people? The people who, the Russian Revolution and the dawn of communism, these are tiny little groups of determined people who are willing to put their life on the line. Christianity, John Vervaeke wants to talk about stealing the culture. Do you want to know the recipe for that? It's networks of people. And so if in fact we are committed, and this I think is part of the reason Christ rules the world, is because if you have any other central thing but love, it's going to go off into all of these other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly gratified when some high status person pays attention to one of us or what we're doing, et cetera, et cetera. I'm also deeply, I fear that too. Because those forces, I mean, let us not pretend, again, we talked about this earlier, that this world is our friend, and the money, the fame, the attention, that Billy Graham didn't go the way of how many others, whatever you think of the movement or evangelicalism, whatever, is a remarkable thing. Because I mean, look at what status has done to Peterson. And now it was a sacrificial blessing in many ways, because it produced a lot of what we have here. But I am reticent to wish that kind of thing too quickly. And I'm much more comfortable with, none of us may be around to see the fruit of what we're doing, but that's in fact what it means to be a Christian. So,
yeah.
No, I think actually a lot of the I think a lot of the conversations that are happening like across the community between the different you know platforms that have developed within the community are actually a lot more important, I think. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I mean, it was your Rando's conversations that kept me invested, like in your channel. Like it was like, I mean, it's like your monologue videos. I saw a couple, like they're okay. You know, but it was the Rando's conversation was like, wait, and what's interesting is like, it was sort of a thing where it was like, I had been thinking about like, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Grim is like, Grim and I actually, we have obviously our styles and approaches are very different, but we are very much both concerned about this fourth wall problem. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about how, like, how much vast untapped human potential there exists out there that is like voiceless. Yes. And the fact that you were and I have been thinking about wanting to do something to do that, and here it is. I run across your channel, and that's what's like, oh, I'm sticking with this guy because he's already doing that. Yeah. Like he's started where he is, and he's trying to do that on whatever scale that he can, and that is exactly the kind of thing that I want to give attention and effort to, because I see the value in that as well. So,
and let's not forget all of the personal transformations. I kept so many people on the Discord, and you know, all of you and all, you know, all the people that I've had the privilege of getting to know have, you know, just been in awe of the personal transformation that they've experienced in their own lives, and me too, myself included.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah.
And in a lot of ways, it's the dialogue itself that is the transformative power. I mean, it's like, because it's like, you don't know what you don't know. The only way, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. The learned ignorance thing that I talked about like way back earlier in the conversation. It's like, the reason it's learned ignorance is because you don't know what you don't know. So you have to be made aware of it, and you can only become aware of it through dialogue.
Yes.
And babies are being born, yeah. Michael.
Yes.
Job.
And couples are getting married.
You know, we take these things for granted. They are not. And I think right now in our present moment, when I hear a generation of young people saying, I'm not going to bring a baby into this world. And I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I think that too, Paul.
No, everyone who has brought a child into this world does so with seriousness, but also with joy, because it is a statement of faith against the darkness that no, you will not take us, and we will continue to lean in though we suffer and die. And that's happening. And so that is not a small thing. So, all right, are we ready to land the plane, or is this something that we should have talked about but haven't gotten around to? I guess we're ready to land the plane.
I guess so.
I just want to say thanks for the invite, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure, and each of you, and many more beyond you, because again, if each of us, the problem with community and selection is that there are always people that, you know, maybe should have been in this conversation but aren't. But you have to limit the numbers in order to facilitate the time and attention. So, but this is, you know, Joey, who has put hours and hours and hours into the Discord server, making it work. Job, who, you know, has, you know, especially in the early days, pastored the Discord. Sherry, you've been a mom of the Discord, but it isn't, you know, again, I also want to emphasize that it's not just the Discord server, because again, when I first said estuary, something happened and people expected me to build an institution. And I say, no, I would much rather have whatever I seed be more like AA than Apple.
Mm.
Because yeah, Apple's this major corporation, yada, 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 all the Steve Jobs, blah, 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 blah. AA, you know, most people can't name the guys who founded it, but all over the world, and I know many of them, there are people who they have life to a degree that they never thought they would have it because of the kinds of things that we are talking about here.
I think that's exactly the right model to look at too, because I think I really see it as modeling something for the church.
Mm-hmm.
That's speaking to the church about something about what its own future ought to look like.
And actually what its own future, I mean, we don't give the church enough credit.
No, that's very fair. Yes, absolutely. I'm not saying that the church doesn't do any of that. It does, but it needs to do more.
Yep. And because, again, the vast majority of churches in America are less than 75 people. Yeah. Almost all the churches I worked with overseas were less than 25 people. And so this is actually the structure of the majority church throughout human history.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just too blind to see. So
the power of unity and multiplicity.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will post this on the channel tomorrow, you guys. And I look forward to seeing what the good people have to comment about it. And again, you know, I know what you say, Nate, is true about the Randos conversations always get less views than some, you know, clickbaity thumbnail and title and some video about Jordan Peterson and Elon Musk. But this is the heart of the channel, and this is the heart of the community. So
yeah.
Thank you all.
All right.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye, guys.